set up by way of introduction. I think you all have these sheets, so you'll be able to see them. Those something about this, the two colleagues. Stephen G is a member and former chair of the Society for Contemporary Psychoanalysis. He's contributed to psych conferences on Winnicott, Carr, Osterholz, and Plums. You'll see from other things something about his own wide background and the kind of areas of interest between psychoanalytic thinking and the arts. Brian McGee, who we very much welcome and very pleased to have with us this afternoon. And I don't think I've ever introduced someone speaking about Barton, and who was also a member of Parliament in the 70s and 80s, so very unusual. Brian McGee is well known to all of us. Some people have read his books and remembered his award-winning radio and TV series where he interviewed some of the great thinkers of our time. Stephen G is going to talk with, in dialogue with Brian, and afterwards there will be an opportunity for questions and answers. But because of time, I just want to stop there and move straight on.
Thank you very much. Brian McGee has written two books on Wagner. Aspects of Wagner, first written in 1968 and been reprinted several times since, and Wagner and Philosophy, written in the year 2000 in America, known as the Tristan Chord, Wagner and Philosophy. Brian's going to start by reading two short passages from Aspects of Wagner. It's a chapter called Wagnerolatry, and really, it's been touched on this morning, it's about the phenomenon of Wagner, the passions aroused by him, both of love and hate. It's also been noted this morning that Freud, in different ways, has been an equally controversial figure, exciting both devotion and detraction. And such a phenomenon Brian looks at and tries to explain. He puts both thinkers together in these two short passages he's going to read from, and that's going to be our starting point, and tries to explain it in the manner of when there's a lot of love and hate around, there might be something called transference in the air, and if there is, might need analysing. So, over to Brian, and we'll kick off with him reading from Aspects of Wagner.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. I take it this mic is working all right, is it?
Yeah.
I apologise for starting by reading from a book of my own. I'm not all that keen on hearing authors read their own works, usually. But when you write, as you know, when you write, you pay careful attention to every word, you scrap sentences, you rewrite them and so on, in a way you can't possibly do when you're talking, as we are up here now, off the cuff. And I wanted to read just these few passages, perhaps I'll be reading for about 10 minutes, something like that, because when I was writing this book, I was able to word it so much more carefully than I could do if I were improvising, and that makes it much more economical, but also much more precise, and I thought that would make a better starting point for us. So here we go. I'm talking about the mature operas of Wagner. Their subject matter is, to a remarkable degree, the subject matter of depth psychology. Even today, audiences would be shocked if the first act of a new drama were to consist of a prolonged, passionate love scene between brother and sister, which culminated in sexual intercourse as soon as the curtain was down. Yet this is the first act of the Valkyrie. And in the second act, it is openly and explicitly approved. Wotan, the ruler of the gods, says, "What wrong did these two do when spring united them in love?" And when his wife Fricka, who, let us not forget, is the goddess of marriage, cries out, "My heart shudders, my brain reels, marital intercourse between brother and sister. When did anyone live to see it? Brother and sister, physically lovers." And Wotan replies, "You've lived to see it today. Learn from this that things can happen, though they never happened before. that these two love each other is obvious to you. Listen to some honest advice, smile on their love, and bless Siegmund and Sieglinde's union. Their sweet joy will reward you for your blessing. And a moment later, in words that convince us, as so often, that the voice of Wagner is speaking through Wotan, he says, "You want to understand always only what you are used to. My mind is reaching out towards things that have never happened." In two of the other mature operas of Wagner, Siegfried and Parsifal, Oedipal sexuality is presented and explored. In both of them, the central character is this is both Siegfried and Parsifal as characters. The things I'm about to say are true of both of them. In both of them, the central character is so innocent of life that he knows nothing of either sex or fear. He meets a woman whom he does not consciously identify as a woman. They kiss, and this awakens sexual feeling in him for the first time, and fear with it. His first thought is that this must be his mother, but she tells him that she is not, that his mother is dead, and he himself is the cause, whereon he cries out in an agony of guilt. At one level, all the mature Wagner operas, except the Mastersingers, are like animated textbooks of psychoanalysis. While archetypal psychosexual situations are being acted out and discussed on the stage at exhaustive length, the orchestra is pouring out a flood of the otherwise inexpressible feelings associated with them. And this is the heart of the matter. It's in the orchestra, as Wagner and everyone else since has been aware, that the innermost aspects of the drama are being realized. The most important things in life, namely its psycho-emotional fundamentals as inwardly experienced, are articulated here as they can never be in words, or on the stage, or in any other outward terms. The Wagnerian orchestra is, to quote Thomas Mann, "the kingdom of subliminal knowledge, unknown to the word up there." Wagner knew he was making the orchestra express the world of primitive, unbridled, inchoate feeling below the level of conscious awareness. He stated the theory of it often in his prose writings. A typical example is this, quote, "In the instruments, the primal organs of creation and nature are represented. What they articulate can never be clearly determined or stipulated, because they render primal feeling itself, emergent from the chaos of the first creation, when there may even have been no human beings to take it into their hearts. The particular genius of the human voice is quite different from this. It represents the human heart and all its delimitable individual emotion. Because of this, it is circumscribed in character, but also specific and clear. The thing to do now is bring the two elements together, make them one. Set the clear, specific emotion of the human heart, represented by the voice, against the wild, primal feelings, with their ungovernable urge towards infinitude, represented by the instruments. It will appease and smooth the violence of those feelings, and channel their cross-currents into a single, definite course. Meanwhile, the human heart itself, insofar as it absorbs the primal feelings, will be infinitely enlarged and strengthened and become capable of experiencing with godlike awareness what previously had been a mere inkling of higher things." End of quote. One might put this in Freudian language by saying that the singer's is the voice of the ego, while the orchestra is the voice of the id, so that together they expand consciousness beyond all its normal limits into a total self-awareness of which we are otherwise incapable. One of the many things about Wagner that never ceased to astonish is the high degree to which he was conscious of what he was doing. In his books, abominably written though they are, he shows himself a Freudian before Freud, or perhaps rather a Jungian before Jung, for in them he expands with unprecedented insight the psychic import of myth and of dreams, and the use of symbols, and the function of all these things as alternative languages of unconscious feeling, and hence their unique significance for art. Even in detail, such as the extent to which political and social institutions are illusions, or the partial responsibility of the Christian tradition for man's alienation from his own instinctual life, he anticipated the psychoanalysts. 80 years before Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, he expressed its central thesis in his book Art and Revolution. In Freud's words, quote, "It is impossible to ignore the extent to which civilization is built up on renunciation of instinctual gratifications, the degree to which the existence of civilization presupposes the non-gratification of powerful instinctual urgencies." End of quote. Wagner quite consciously regarded his art as being in revolt against civilization in this sense, a reassertion of hitherto repressed natural feeling. In the somewhat Marx-flavoured idiom characteristic of his political writing at the time, he expressed it as follows, beginning of quote, "In the progress of civilization, so inimical to man, we can at least look forward to this happy consequence. The burdens and constraints it lays on what is natural grow to such gigantic proportions that in the end it builds up in crushed but indestructible nature the pressure necessary to fling them off with a single violent gesture. It is the job of art specifically to reveal to this social force its own noblest import and show it its true direction." My contention, then, is that Wagner's music expresses, as does no other art, repressed and highly charged contents of the psyche, and that this is the reason for its uniquely disturbing effect. It is the abandoned utterance of what has been in some way forbidden, and thus presents us with the life of feeling that we all in our heart of hearts would like to live, but in the real world never can live. A life in which our most passionate desires and their expression are unrestrained. Life as it would be if the id could have its way. Well, that's the end of the quotation from me.
Thank you, Brian. Well, let's first go back to the what you were first quoting, the second act of the Valkyrie, when Wotan is having this argument with his wife. Brunhilde's just left. Fricka arrives and she says, "What do you think you're doing?" Encouraging not only adultery, but incest. And if we can go back to the first act of the Valkyrie, and what you're saying about the orchestra, the way Wagner's orchestra gives utterance to these primal feelings, because in the first act of the Valkyrie, and I think one of the speakers this morning said he was listening it was Stephen, I think, listening to the first act of the Valkyrie that swept away his reservations about Wagner, that the orchestra comes into its own and sweeps us away. So we're watching this play, if you like, about incest, and yet we're carried away with it.
I think the first act of Valkyrie is unique. It's unique in lots of ways. It's the only single act of Wagner, of any of Wagner's operas, which is commonly played as a concert item, as an item in symphony concerts. It's only just over an hour long. It's about 1 hour and 5 minutes, or 1 hour and 10 minutes long, and it quite often is made the main item. It's shorter than a lot of Mahler symphonies. It's made the main item in a symphony concert. There are, of course, other acts of Wagner, like Act II of Tristan, which are sometimes played in concerts, but none anything like as often as this one. And this is partly because only three voices are required, but it's also partly because the music is so spellbinding. The music is absolutely marvellous. And it's in that act that Wagner found, so to speak, the voice of his own unconscious, really. Because it's quite unlike anything previously in Wagner. From then on, you get the sense with all Wagner's mature works that the music is sort of gushing from his unconscious, as it were. And you don't get that feeling until Act One of the Valkyrie. And then it all comes pouring out. So there is something special about that act. And it is from then on that music, as it were, takes over as the primary element in his operas. He had previously published his famous theory, verbal theory, of the combined work of art, the Gesamtkunstwerk, in which all the elements in the work of art were supposed to unite with one another on equal terms. And he tried to compose something very like that in the Rheingold. But with Act One of the Valkyrie, as Stephen has just said, the music just simply sweeps all before it. And that's how it goes on for the rest of Wagner's output. I think, to some extent, actually, in a lot of different ways, Wagner has illusions about himself. And one of the ways in which he did was that he thought he was a great poet. So that he thought that he was writing great poetry, which he was setting to great music. I don't think anyone since has seriously thought that. The music in almost everybody's mind, there can scarcely be any exception to this, is the utterly predominant element in his work. I think that if it were not for the music, the incredible beauty of the music, we today wouldn't be interested in Wagner and we wouldn't be having this conference. It's the music that governs all, and that begins with Act One of the Valkyrie.
But Shakespeare's been quoted already today, music be the food of love, play on. Now, love in Wagner, he was composing the Valkyrie, he started in 1854, didn't he?
Yeah.
There'd been the failure of the revolution in Dresden, he was now in exile, Bakunin and Ruckel had been arrested. But his revolutionary thinking was based on Feuerbach, as we mentioned this morning, and an idea that love could transform power relations, that you could get a society, people working together without a state, and that love would be the transforming element, which is there in the first act of Valkyrie. But it's brought up short by Fricka, and the argument between Fricka and Wotan. And shortly after this, I think it's after the second act of the Valkyrie, there's a change in Wagner, isn't there? He reads Schopenhauer. Could you take the story up there? What's happening?
I will, but I'd like to comment on something you said just before you got to that point. Something that recurs in Wagner is the presentation of impassioned lovers from a standpoint that leaves you in no doubt whatever that the author, in this case Wagner, is on their side. But when they are presented as being in conflict with the surrounding society, they don't win. In romantic fiction, romantic films and everything else, they do win. But in Wagner's operas, they don't. What happens is that the very fact that they are so violently breaking social conventions results in their destruction. This happens not only to Siegmund and Sieglinde, at least it doesn't happen to Sieglinde, but it happens to Siegmund. And I suppose you could say indirectly it happens to Sieglinde. It also happens to Tristan and Isolde. They are overwhelmingly in love with each other, and if you can talk about any music sweeping anybody away, it's the music of Tristan. But society will not allow it, and society destroys them. So there is no, so to speak, romantic illusion about how, as you often hear it said, love conquers all. It doesn't conquer all. All conquers love. But the way the love is expressed on the way is just simply fantastic. Stephen referred to Wagner's discovery of Schopenhauer, and it's been said by almost everybody who who's studied Wagner's life closely that it was unquestionably the most important single intellectual event of his life, and it was. And one of the effects that it had on him was his view of the music, the place of music in opera. To explain that very clearly, I'm not going to go on about this at great length, but to explain this clearly, you need to take a couple of paces back to, again, what Stephen mentioned, the revolution of 48-49. The 48 revolution happened in 49 in Dresden, but it's the same revolution we're talking about. Wagner's disillusionment with that was so extreme that he went into a depression, a serious depression. And it was deepened by the fact that only 3 years later, Louis Napoleon carried out his famous coup and established himself as, in effect, dictator. And it seemed to Wagner, and indeed it seemed to most of the active revolutionaries, the death of all their hopes. In fact, it was accompanied by the biggest ever wave of emigration from the German-speaking world to the United States. And what was very distinctive about that was that they were the only huge wave of immigrants who were not poor or unemployed or persecuted or oppressed. They were predominantly well-to-do, well-educated, middle-class people. They were writers, lawyers, teachers, etc., etc. That had an enormous effect on America. And Wagner himself seriously, as I expect you know, considered going and making his life in America. Well, he became disillusioned with politics. He had thought that there was going to be a new society. Like a lot of young socialists, like me when I was a young socialist, like millions of us, he thought that the coming of socialism was inevitable, that it was bound to happen, that nothing, it was only a question of time, nothing could stop it. And I think, being the great artistic genius that he was, he was always primarily interested in politics and in revolution, which he believed in, or had believed in, until he became disillusioned. He was interested in that not primarily because of their direct political and social consequences, but because he thought that they were required for the well-being and future of art. He thought that in his contemporary society, art was in a very corrupt situation, not least the art with which he was most closely concerned, the art of opera. He thought it was commercialized, it had become sort of entertainment for tired businessmen and their wives, it was being poured out by people who had no serious interest in the artistic side of it at all, and he wanted a revolution in society because he thought it would be good for art, and the art of music, and the art of opera, and of course he thought it would be good for his art. Well, as a result of the events of 1948 and 51, he became disillusioned with the ability of politics and political activity to change society in the way that he thought it ought to be changed. He became disillusioned with politics as such and turned away from politics, at first in despair. And as I said a moment ago, he was suffering from a serious depression. And it was in that state that he read Schopenhauer. And Schopenhauer is a quite otherworldly philosopher in many ways. He's, in the Western tradition of great philosophers, he's really the only one who is serious, has serious intellectual connections with the great Eastern philosophies of Buddhism and Hinduism. And in the what he really believes in the end is that this worldly matters are ultimately unimportant, that everything that really matters, so to speak, belongs to a world other than this, and that all our most serious problems, insofar as they have solutions at all, don't have solutions in terms of political and social activity. They have solutions in terms of psychological, inward, spiritual, if you like, activity of an entirely different kind. And another thing that Schopenhauer and Wagner, of course, followed that way of thinking, culminating in Parsifal.
Another thing that Schopenhauer taught had specifically to do with the arts. There were very few of the great philosophers who had much to say about the arts, but Schopenhauer did. He thought the arts were of supreme importance. But far from thinking that they were of equal potential, he thought that one of the arts was a sort of super art, and that was music. And it was precisely because of music's inability to delineate specifics in the way that language can. I mean, if you're going to have an opera about Romeo and Juliet, the music can't tell you that this is Romeo and that is Juliet, and that they belong to two families who have a tradition of violent opposition to one another. Music can't tell you that. Music can express some of the emotions associated with it, but it can't, as it were, fill in the background and the names and the dates and the story and so on. And it is precisely music's ability to express emotion in itself, as it were, free from the conceptualizing intellect, that made music a super art. It was like, as it were, the direct expression in this world of the inner nature of things. And Wagner seized on that. Wagner thought, well, yes, that's really what I've always thought, he thought. And he came to think that too. And directly following from this, in the course of his development, directly following from this new, on his part, view of music as an expression of the inner nature of things in a way that words could never be, there follows a huge development in the role played by the orchestra in the operas relative to the voices, until by the time you get to Götterdämmerung, the orchestra is really the preponderant voice of the drama, and even more so in Parsifal. Mm. I've answered at great length, but yes. I hope the point...
Well, I think it brings some more links there for us, and one of them might be to Freud, because I think we're aware that Freud said he'd not read Schopenhauer. He probably did, I think, later on in his life, but was acknowledged him as a sort of forerunner, particularly where there are ideas of the unconscious. But not only that, perhaps some of the, as you say, there's Schopenhauer was the first philosopher to take seriously Hinduism and Buddhism, and that influenced Wagner as well. And perhaps there's a trace of that in Freud's idea of the Nirvana complex, which is an idea of reducing all tension to zero, linked with pleasure, linked with death, which links us back, perhaps, to the opera that interrupted The Ring, that he had to compose, that came to him as a pure musical conception, which was Tristan und Isolde, the great paean to love, which is the nearest thing one can say to it being a Schopenhauerian opera.
Yeah.
He'd read Schopenhauer by then, he was steeped in it. And in your book, you say that the transition that we've been talking about, Wagner, the revolutionary, after he'd read Schopenhauer, after this depression, he goes from politics... Not from left to right, so much as from politics to metaphysics. And in Tristan, perhaps we could talk a little about Tristan, because your second book is called The Tristan Chord.
Yes.
Brings us back to the music again. Yes. What is that chord?
Well, this is an astonishing example, perhaps the most extreme example there could ever be of the influence of a philosopher on a composer. In a letter to Liszt, Wagner says that he got the idea for Tristan and Isolde partially from his reading of Schopenhauer. And one might think, my goodness, how can you get the idea of that from reading of Schopenhauer? And when you read Schopenhauer, if you ever do, you see why. Schopenhauer believed, as the Buddhists do, that life is full of conflict, of eventually unassuageable conflict, that ultimate satisfaction is impossible in life, that all of us end in the ultimate kind of shipwreck of death. He thinks, as I said before, that the super art that can express fundamental human concerns is music. And he actually writes at one point about the device that's then it's a perfectly common, and Bach used it, it's a well-known device used in music called suspension. But he actually prints a musical example of this. It's the only instance I can think of in the whole of Western philosophy where a great philosopher has a musical example printed on the page in his work to show you what suspension is. And as many people in this room will know, it's a very simple device whereby when you think you're coming to the end of the work, the last chord but one in a work often leads you. It's a discord that expects the final resolution on the final tonic chord. But some composers sometimes, Bach did it, Handel did it, they all did it, was to mislead you. You get what you think is going to be the penultimate chord, and then instead of getting the resolution of that chord onto the final concord, that discord leads to another discord, that's why it's called suspension, and then that discord is resolved onto the final concord. So you get this, as it were, heightened, unexpected feeling of expectation and tension, which is, finally resolved on the final concord. Well, it's quite clear that reading that in Schopenhauer gave Wagner, I'm putting this terribly crudely, but for the sake of brevity, it's true, it gave Wagner the idea of composing a whole work on the basis of this idea. On the basis of chords, the use of chords which in music are known as discords, they don't necessarily sound discordant, but a discord, which, when they move, don't move to resolution, as they're always expected to do, but they move to another discord. And the first chord in the history of music to do this in the expressive way that both Schopenhauer and Wagner had in mind is the first full chord in the Tristan Prelude. It contains, I don't think, one doesn't even need an oral example to make this point to you. That first chord in Tristan contains within itself two discords. When it moves to a different chord, one of those discords is resolved, but the other isn't. So you get partial resolution, but partial non-resolution. And that moves to another chord, which is partially resolved, but a new discord has entered in. And so you go through the whole evening with Tristan, in which discords are being resolved, but at the same time other discords are being recreated, and you never get a complete concord until you get to the end of an act or the end of the whole opera. And one of the, again, language is so crude in trying to put into words what these things are expressing, but one of them quite certainly is the inevitability of inner conflict in life and in relationships, and the only ultimate resolution is when it all stops, and that's death, you know. Tristan is to an astonishing degree a Schopenhauerian work, because if you're familiar with the philosophy of Schopenhauer, and because I wrote a book about the philosophy of Schopenhauer, I became very familiar with it, you find that the libretto is full of figures of speech and images and metaphors and so on, which are taken from Schopenhauer. It's Schopenhauerian at every level, both, and that level includes, astonishingly, the music itself.
The famous French psychoanalyst who claiming he was returning to Freud, Jacques Lacan, said that the aim of psychoanalysis was to encourage the analysand to follow his desire to the end, jusqu'au bout.
it could well have been, that could well be a recommendation for listening to Tristan and Isolde, because it holds us in suspense, and it's an opera about desire, until that final resolution, that B major chord, which ends on Isolde singing Höchste Lust, unbewusst, höchst, unconscious, highest pleasure. Yeah. Two more buzzwords from Freud's, unconscious and lust, which is our translation, a weak translation, is pleasure, the pleasure principle.
Yeah.
Pleasure principle, beyond the pleasure principle, the end of Tristan Isolde, the end of life.
Yeah. And that last chord contains a marvellous example. Well, when we look at the great medieval cathedrals, we are told how the crafts, because the craftsmen thought they were building this cathedral not for the greater glory of man, but for the greater glory of God. So they put in all sorts of detailed, marvellous work in places that nobody's ever going to see, sort of tucked away out of sight in the roof where you have to climb up ladders and scaffolding to get to and so on. There are all these marvellous things. Well, I sometimes think that Wagner was a bit like this in his scores. He puts in an enormous amount of work on the inner parts that... As if people are going to hear what he's doing. But one great example of this, I think, is the last act of Tristan, because throughout that last act of Tristan, the voice of Tristan's unassuageable or unassuaged longing is the cor anglais, isn't it? It's so desolate, it's playing throughout, and Tristan tells us in that wonderful long monologue about how he knew this tune from his childhood, and it was always playing, seemed to be playing when things went wrong and so on. This marvellous long cor anglais thing, which throughout that act expresses Tristan's longing. When you get to the very final chord of Tristan, the whole orchestra is playing, except for the cor anglais. Because at that moment, in just that final chord, Tristan's longing is still. Now, I doubt whether there's anyone with such a fine ear that they can actually hear that in a whole Wagnerian orchestra playing, there's one instrument that isn't playing. So that's an example of Wagner filling his work, which he does, with things that, you know, I wouldn't claim to be able to hear that the cor anglais isn't playing. He fills his work with things like that, which leave one astounded, really, at the mastery.
Brian, incredibly, we've almost come to the time we're allowed for this discussion here, but we've got questions from the audience.
Good.
But there's just one, just to bring something out about what followed Tristan. I mean, you say in one of your books that if Tristan is about longing, Sehnen, in German, longing, desire, desire realized or not realized, then in Parsifal, which is his last opera, the problematics of sexuality and desire, because it's sexual desire, are explored in both Parsifal and in Kundry, in man, in the female figure as well as the male figure. But that is about something else, about Mitleid, which is a translation of, compassion is a translation of Mitleid, which is, you know, again, akin to the Buddhist ideas, the Schopenhauerian ideas. And it's a very different musical texture, a very different kind of world that you have there. But it's dealing with these incredible contradictions and difficulties that are being dealt with all the time, you know, by psychoanalysis, our sexual life, what's permissible, how much we can enjoy, what we're up against.
Yeah. One interesting fact about that, I talked a few minutes ago about how the orchestra assumed greater and greater and greater preponderance in Wagner's work as he developed. By the time, I mean, for example, when he began his extensive use of leitmotifs with Rheingold, most, nearly all the leitmotifs are introduced, first of all, in direct association with particular words that are being sung, or with the particular character who is central to the moment. And then when they appear afterwards, of course, the character doesn't have to be there, the words don't have to be being sung, because the leitmotif will bring them to your mind, will recall them to your mind, and that's partly what the leitmotifs are for. As his work develops, more and more of the leitmotifs are introduced in the orchestra. The new ones, it goes on using the old ones, of course, but more and more of the new ones are introduced in the orchestra, so that they're not associated with words at all. They have no original association with words. Until when you get to Parsifal, only one important leitmotif in the whole of Parsifal is introduced in connection with words. All the others make their first appearance in the orchestra. And the word that it's introduced in connection with is Mitleid, is Fruit. Compassion. Durch Mitleid wissen, der reine Tor. I won't keep making side dashes into Schopenhauer, except to say that Schopenhauer comes into this a lot too, because Schopenhauer regarded himself as completing and correcting and completing the work of his great predecessor, Kant. And Kant had thought that morality, ethics, was based on rationality, that it was something that was the result of our being rational creatures, that we had morality, and our morality was based on rationality. And Schopenhauer rejected that. He thought that rationality was based on feeling, and what it was on the feeling of that we are members one of another. He thought that that was the foundation of rationality, that the foundation of rationality was compassion. That the foundation of morality was compassion. And all that comes into what we're discussing, but there are so many things here that one can't chase all the leads, so to speak.
So, we'll open it out, I think, now.
I'm sure you just all are. Encore. Now, I'm going to ask two things. I think it's impossible. I think I'm not alone. I'm sure it's not a projection, but it's very warm. Good, thank you. Is everyone happy about it? It does feel very stuffy. Let's go straight to questions, please.
Thank you very much for a fascinating presentation. You spoke about the influence of Schopenhauer, and then you also talked about the progression of in Wagner of discord leading to resolution, leading to new discord. Isn't that also reminiscent of dialectical philosophy, as in Hegel and Marx? And also you talked about Wagner reacting against the defeat of the 1848 revolution and making his peace with society, as it were. But at the end of Goethe Dämmerung, we have the destruction of Valhalla. Is that not perhaps to be interpreted in some sense as Wagner's revenge against the existing society, against the existing order, or the old order?
Well, I think there are two points there. To take the second one first, I think it may well have been what was in Wagner's mind when he wrote the libretto of The Ring. Of course, part of the problem there is that The Ring took him altogether 26 years to write to complete. And when he wrote the libretto, which he did first, he was a young left-wing revolutionary. He was a socialist. He called himself a socialist. He once or twice even called himself a communist. He was a left-wing revolutionary. And what you say, I think, may well be right when he started. But it was no longer the case when he finished. And he had great problems about how to end The Ring. And as you probably know, he wrote afterwards alternative endings, which he ended up not using any of. But he was very much in doubt about how it should all end, because he was certain that the end of things was not going to be what he'd thought of as an idealistic young socialist. when he'd written the libretto. The point you make about dialectic philosophers like Marx and Hegel is interesting, but neither of them, I've read both of their, the works of both of them pretty extensively, and I can't think of any reflection anywhere in either of them of any possible connection with music. Whereas in the case of Schopenhauer, he actually prints the musical example in his book. I mean, this is the point, really. And that's where Wagner got it from. Yeah.
How far do you, John Martin UCL, how far do you think that the music of Wagner has approached an Aristotelian concept of metaphysics, which is beyond Kantian, beyond Schopenhauer, which is existence as existence? And I think if any artist done it, it might be certainly at the end of it. I have read a lot of those things. And I do like existentia by existentia, which is the ultimate analysis of what existence in some ways. I have a feeling that we might be approaching a feeling, some perception we have feelings, but we're approaching a feeling of existence itself.
Well, I think that's very interesting, and I'm very sympathetic to that sort of line of inquiry. When Wagner was a young man, he wrote, among the many things he wrote a short story when he was living in Paris, in which one of the characters is made to say that poetry expresses this or that particular love of this or that person for this or that person and all the rest of it. And hope and fear and so on. But music is different because music expresses love in itself and hope in itself and fear in itself and so on. So you have this idea, which is, I think, not exactly what you're saying, but it is related to what you're saying, very early on. There is no doubt that what Wagner expresses in music does go far beyond language, and he was the first person, of course, to realise this, and wrote a great deal about both the connection and the problems that it creates.
Hi, Peter Tappas, I'm just from Darth, and I just wonder if we could shift our focus to work. It may be something that I haven't picked up, but mentioned we may go into transference and counter-transference speak. It's not a model that I know very well, the psychodynamic model. I wonder if you can comment on what you had in mind when you were saying we were going to go into those sort of concepts.
Well, that was you. That was me, dude. It was really just a sort of forerunner to Brian's attempt in Aspects of Wagner to explain this phenomenon of why Wagner, among all composers, I mean, Simon Callow's play Inside Wagner's Head starts with this, and I think he, you know, he's been in discussions with you, that no other figure, Wagner, excites such either adoration or detraction. And it's not to say that some of the detraction isn't deserved. Again, in Stephen's paper this morning, he talked extensively about Wagner's anti-Semitism, and that always has to be taken seriously. But there's something about the music. I mean, there's only transference, counter-transference, and so on, and that's perhaps for another conference, where there is the concept and the idea of an unconscious. And it may be that in all our reactions, particularly our reactions to Wagner and Freud, our reactions in all our relationships, where there's strong feelings, that there's a carryover. In German it's Übertragung, a carryover from one figure in our past or our present to another. And really this is what my comment at the beginning was, that Brian is quite prescient in 1968, to be bringing Freud and Wagner together.
I thought it wasn't an accident that it was 1968, which was also the year of revolutions as well, in which a lot of people were trying to sort of burst the bounds of convention and society and experiment with sex and drugs and rock and roll and the lot. And perhaps we're still picking up the pieces, but that's based, I don't know whether that answers your question, but it's a bit of a riff on it.
Can we go to fifth?
Anne Case, Jungian psychoanalyst. I just want to continue what your point to make on transubstantial transference, and to say also what Graham Greene was saying about pre-Jung, that what I think consolates a kind of idealization as demonization is what Jung would refer to as archetypal transference, kind of transference. And I could say a lot more about that, but archetypal, you mentioned, I think, in your talk, which, again, very interesting what you're saying about voice equals ego, music equals it. In Jung, one might say voice equals ego, music equals the collective unconscious, which was as well the archetypes.
Well, since that isn't a question, I won't give it an answer, but I will say, for the interest of this audience, because not everybody may know, that there is a Jungian analyst called Donington who wrote a whole book about the ring, which consists of a Jungian analysis of the ring. And although I don't, as it were, buy the whole package, which I don't, I think that book is full of good insights, of good thoughts, and I think that that book is very well worth reading. And if there's anybody here of a Jungian persuasion, I'm very, very sure that they will find it worth reading. It's called Wagner's Ring and Its Symbols. It's by a man called Donington.
Fifth was family therapist and systemic psychotherapist. I wanted to come back to a phrase you brought in, Brian, about the inevitability of inner conflict in life, which linked also in my mind with our first speaker's paper about hysteria and private theatre. I worked for 10 years in the field of psychosomatics in children and young people, very extreme forms of it. And one of my kind of learning points from that area of work was that the idea that young people who went into what could commonly be called as hysterical paralysis, what do you call that now, had some kind of inner conflict which couldn't be spoken about in the family, things that couldn't be voiced, which was, I think, touched upon by Gavin in terms of the Anna O example. And now, talking about opera, Wagner, music, made me wonder about how far opera has a place in society in helping all of us to somehow or another, by association, resolve inner conflict in a way that avoids illness and aggression.
Well, that's a very big subject. And it's not the kind of thing I like to talk about off the top of my head, because it does, it requires a great deal of reflection. I might in this room say, well, you can't libel the dead, and it's not libelous anyway, but I'll tell you something that I think illuminates this. In my television days, it's a long time ago now, it's before Edward Heath was Prime Minister, I made a one-hour documentary for television about Edward Heath as a musician. And it took about 6 weeks to make, and it involved my being with him every day for 6 weeks. I went with a film unit down to his infant home and to Oxford to film him playing the organ in his old college where he was organ scholar and all the rest of it. And in the course of this, I got to know Edward Heath pretty well. And at the end of each day's filming, when the crew dispersed and they all went home to their wives and children, Edward Heath, of course, had to go back to an empty flat. And over again, he would ask me to go back to his flat with him for a drink. And I came to realise that he was sort of afraid of going back to that flat. He was afraid of the emptiness, of the aloneness. And I talked about this to some of his closest friends. I told him when I started making the film that I wanted to have the view of him of people who knew him best, and I didn't want to do it behind his back, so I said, "Is that all right by you?" And he said, "Yes." And I put this to some of his closest friends, and they said, and this is where I get to something that bears on your question, yes, for Ted, music is the way of having passionate emotions without personal relationships. Now, that's a great insight, really, I think, and it was true of him. I wouldn't have said that if he'd been alive, but I think I don't mind saying it now he's dead. Yeah.
Margaret Riley, former lecturer in German literature, and before my question, I'd just like to put a plea for Gardner's Libretti, which actually I think are extraordinarily highly wrought, full of fascinating hidden allusions, and well worth studying and honouring.
Yeah.
My question is, I was fascinated to hear you say that Freud really didn't acknowledge a debt to Schopenhauer, nor indeed did he really acknowledge a debt to Nietzsche or Freud. My memory is that...
Is that Freud, you said?
Freud, yes, that Freud didn't
acknowledge a debt to...
debt to Schopenhauer.
No.
Nor did he really acknowledge a debt to Nietzsche or to Wagner. My memory is... As a student, Freud belonged to a student reading body which read mainly Schopenhauer, Wagner, and Freud. And Wagner's prose writings, including opera and drama, have a tremendous amount of extraordinary exploration of the unconscious. Indeed, Wagner called himself the poet, the knower of the unconscious. Mm. And is it possible that Freud learned rather more than he acknowledged, for example, out of incest being apparently natural, male and female element coexisting within one person, particularly within Wagner, and Übertragung of personality, Gundry, for example, also embodying Herodias and Gundridia from Wagner's prose writings.
Well, perhaps you took my use of the word debt, perhaps I was mistaken in using that word. What Freud denied was that he was influenced by Schopenhauer. He fully acknowledged that what you might call the central line of argument of psychoanalysis is spelled out by Schopenhauer, that mental illness is caused by inner conflict, that we have this inner conflict because we are repressing powerful emotions or emotions or whatever it is that are extremely important to us. We are repressing them because we can't face up to them. And that it's our inability to face up to them that is causing the distress. All this is spelled out almost as directly and unambiguously by Schopenhauer as I've just spelt it out now. And it's fundamental to Freudianism. Now, people on all sides said this to Freud. You know, Schopenhauer said all this, they say. And Freud said, well, I didn't get it from him. I thought of it for myself. In other words, he may have done. I'm not, because I don't think it matters who thought of it. I really don't. I think that it's irrelevant who thought of it. He also greatly admired Nietzsche. He's quoted by his biographer, Ernest Jones, of having said that Nietzsche knew himself better than any other human being has ever known himself. Well, from Freud, of all people, that's as high praise as you could possibly get. But so I think he was claiming not to have been influenced by them, which is a different thing. I think he wanted us to think that his ideas were his ideas. And I think it matters so little that I don't even particularly want to argue about it, if you see what I mean. I mean, Freud, it seems to me obvious that he was a genius, that he was a man full of ideas. Like all great geniuses, he helped himself at large to other people's ideas. And I don't really think that matters. On the point of Wagner's libretti, then one thing you say that I agree with, I think they are marvellous for their purpose. I think they are wonderful libretti. They are not, as it were, they shouldn't be considered as self-sufficient works of art. They need the music to become themselves. But Wagner thought they were great poetry. I mean, this is instanced by the fact that before any of them had been performed, he had, for example, he had the libretto of The Ring privately printed and sent copies of it to all his friends. So he obviously thought that just reading the libretto would be a great experience for them. He even sent a copy of it to Schopenhauer, whom he'd never met. And Schopenhauer read it. And Schopenhauer, it's interesting this, Schopenhauer was a bit miffed that this copy of The Ring libretto arrived from somebody that he'd barely heard of, without any covering letter. That's what miffed Schopenhauer. He thought it was very rude just to send him the book. So he didn't answer. And the two never met. There was never any direct contact between the two at all. But what he did do is he settled down and read it. And when I was writing my book about Schopenhauer, I spent several days in the library, his library, which has been preserved at the University of Frankfurt, because he used to make notes alongside every book he read. He made notes alongside it. So I, of course, had a special interest in what the notes that he made in The Ring. He made quite a few. And he thought it was a good poem. He was very impressed by the use that Wagner made of Nordic myth in a way that made it alive and interesting to a contemporary, a 19th century audience. And it actually galvanized him into going to see one of Wagner's early operas, which were the only ones that were being at all widely performed at that time. It must have been either The Flying Dutchman or Tannhäuser. And he came from that saying, well, Wagner is a good minor poet, but he's not much of a composer.
One last question.
I don't know what the question is, but you were touching on it in the sense, trying to describe the power of music as somehow representing the ears. So I think one of the things about why people love Wagner so much, when they love Wagner so much, is that it's not like just the emotions of Verdi, Puccini, or Beethoven. It's somehow the music takes you further than you've ever been, or you could even imagine going. And I just wonder what that's all about. You know, it's taking us, it's like a transcendental experience. I mean, I always thought when I was a teenager that Wagner must have understood the human essence so much to be able to move people further than anybody else. And then almost when I read Freud, I kind of almost felt the same about Freud, that he understood people so well. And it somehow kind of, it sort of brings them together.
Well, Wagner's definition of great art, he said that it's the conscious and proclaimed unconscious. It's the proclaimed unconscious. It was described by Thomas Mann, and I wrote this quotation down in case I want to use it, but I do want to use it. Wagner's operas were described by Thomas Mann as a perfectly unique eruption of talent and genius, the achievement at once deeply serious and completely ravishing of a magician. Now, that's really what I think too, and a lot of people have thought so as well. And it's why people who think, as I do, think that this work is so incredibly beautiful. And as this conference shows, not just beautiful, but it's profoundly interesting, and it's full of ideas and all sorts of things which have no necessary connection with beauty at all. It is so wonderful that I've never resisted criticisms of Wagner, because he's open to criticism just like anybody else, and he wasn't right about everything. He wasn't right about being a great poet, in my opinion. But his achievement so far transcends the criticisms that they don't seem to me to really cut much ice. And since that's the final, the end of our piece, I wrote one quotation from Wagner, which I thought I had to put before you as people with a particular interest in Freud and psychology. Wagner wrote, "Today we have only to interpret the Oedipus myth in a way that keeps faith with its essential meaning to get a coherent picture from it of the whole history of mankind."